Welcome to Signs of Life, exploring survival of consciousness. Brought to you by Forever Family Foundation, on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
I call your name, the echo is haunting, the echo is always the same. I call your name, the echo is haunting, an echo can never be changed, so I call your name.
Hello and welcome to Signs of Life Radio. I'm Bob Ginsberg. Thank you for joining us tonight. Our guest tonight is Michael Tim. And Mike has contributed more than 1,600 articles to some 50 publications over the past 50 years. His metaphysical and paranormal articles have appeared in a wide variety of publications. He has authored, I believe, 8 books, and Mike will have to correct me if I'm wrong. The latest book is No One Really Dies, 25 Reasons to Believe in an Afterlife. And Mike, over the years, has found strong evidence for survival of consciousness and a more intelligent afterlife than provided by Orthodox religion. He's impelled to bring this evidence to the attention of others, especially those in despair. And you can follow his blog by going to whitecrowbooks.com/ his name, Michael Tim, and Tim is spelled T-Y-M-N. But if you don't want to remember that, you could go to the Afterlife Science tab on our website at foreverfamilyfoundation.org. And under Consciousness Blogs, you'll find a link to Michael. And he has some interesting articles in there on a regular basis. So, Mike, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Bob. I appreciate it. Right on everything, 8 books. One of them is on running, and the other 7 are on metaphysical subjects. But I updated the 1,600 to about 2,000. I haven't exactly counted them, but I think 2,000 articles. But I should point out that over 1,000 of those are on sports subjects, not on metaphysical subjects.
Yeah. Well, you know, speaking of that, I mean, you had a long career in the corporate world, and you had other interests. Like you just mentioned, you were a competitive runner. What was it that provoked such a strong interest in an afterlife?
I'm not really sure. It just came about gradually. Sometime after I turned 50, I'm 84 now, and I grew up in the Catholic Church and remained with the Catholic Church until I was about in my early 30s, and then I just grew away from the church, and sometime around 50, I said, I've got to get involved with some religion. And I attended a few Protestant churches, and they just didn't do it for me. And I happened to be on a trip from New York City to Atlanta, Georgia on the train. I stopped in Washington, D.C. and looked for a book at the bookstand there and found one by Edgar Cayce on reincarnation, and that sort of triggered everything. I started reading about near-death experiences and mediumship and so forth, and it just grew until, you know, when I retired from my regular job in 2002, I just started writing more and more about it.
Yeah, and most of your research and writing has to do with mediumship and mediums and scientists and researchers from 100 years or more ago. I mean, so do you think that possibly we have more to learn from that era than we do from the current research?
I definitely think so. I think I suggested in my book and in other articles, I believe the legal doctrine of res judicata, which means that it has already been decided, applies to all the research that was carried out before around 1935. Sometimes I put the date at 1920 and 1930, but it was really during the 1930s that psychical research gave way to parapsychology. Parapsychology wanted nothing to do with spirits or, you know, life after death. They just focused on telepathy and psychokinetic manifestations and so forth. And so that was sort of the end of psychical research during the 1930s. And I believe at that time there was more than enough evidence, compelling evidence, to make a legal case for life after death. Everything that's come about since then, reincarnation, past life studies, near-death experiences, deathbed visions, induced after-death communication, and so forth, it's all icing on the cake, so to speak, but I think the cake was baked, you know, before 1935.
You know, you wrote something in your introduction that I resonated with me. In your intro to No One Really Dies, you said that on a personal level regarding life after death, you're 98.8% convinced. It's interesting you have it exact like that. And the reason it resonated with me is that many years ago when I first started reading and learning about the evidence for life after death, and there was a scientist that we were working with and I was friendly with, and he called me up every week. It was when I first started. He asked me where I was, you know, in terms of a belief in the afterlife, and I was probably at 10 or 20%. So every week he'd call me, or at least certainly once a month, and I'd give him an update. And the more I learned, the higher the percentage got. You know, I'm at 50%, I'm at 60%. So you're at 98.8%. Is there anything that could move you to 100%? Or do you think that possibly there always should be some doubt, because that keeps us moving in the right direction?
Yeah, I've often quoted a quote from Victor Hugo's work, actually. Supposedly Hugo was, this was after he was on the Isle of Jersey, and sitting with several mediums, I forget their names offhand, but he asked one, he was supposedly communicating with the spirit of Martin Luther, and he asked the spirit why God doesn't better reveal himself. And the answer he got was that because doubt is the instrument which forges the human spirit. If the day were to come when the human spirit no longer doubted, the human soul would fly off and leave the plow behind, for it would have acquired wings. The earth would lie fallow. Now God is the sower and man the harvester. The celestial seed demands that the human plowshare remain in the furrow of life. Now, I interpret that to mean that doubt is a good thing, that if we knew with absolute certainty, with 100% certainty, that we live on after death, we probably wouldn't live our lives in the same way that we're living them now. I've given a lot of thought to that. I'm not sure how much different my life would be if I knew for certain. I mean, the 98.8% certainty is enough for me. The 1%, with 1.2% doubt is, you know, is there. But there are people who are at, you know, much less percentage that maybe they would live their lives differently if they had an absolute certainty. I don't know. I think I know a few who would, but
yeah,
I don't know.
I agree. I mean, I think it's also important not to take everything, you know, whether we're talking about communications from the other side or absolute truths. I think we all should be open-minded skeptics to a certain degree and analyticals, and that makes the truly unbelievable occurrences that happen even more powerful, because we're able to step back and look at it from a broader perspective. But before we keep going on, do you mind taking some calls from listeners? I have, let's go to the phone lines. I have Anita from California.
Okay.
Anita? Oh, I'm sorry, we have a big connection here. All right, well, that phone, you know, connection, we couldn't make it. So let's keep going. I've heard people use the argument that since you can't prove the existence of God, you can't prove the existence of an afterlife. And to many people, you know, God and an afterlife go hand in hand. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it's a big mistake thinking that you have to prove God before you can consider the evidence for an afterlife. First of all, you have to define God. I mean, if we're talking about an anthropomorphic God, a human-like God, I'm only about 5% on that. As far as a creative force or human power of some kind, cosmic consciousness, whatever you want to call it, I'm at 98.8% on that too. But, you know, it's such an abstract area that you're never going to prove anything. So I believe in that's a deductive approach. First, you got to prove God, and then you look at the evidence for an afterlife. I believe the inductive approach is more appropriate. That is, look at all the evidence, and if you come to the conclusion that their consciousness does survive death, then you might jump to, you know, you might move to the probability that a God of some kind, whatever, however you want to define him, her, or it, whatever it is, is present. So that's the way I look at it.
Yeah, and also when you look at the reports from, you know, let's say from near death experiencers, you know, and they talk about being on the other side, you know, when they're physically dead, and they very rarely talk about God per se, but they talk about being surrounded by love and compassion, and seeing some loved ones that, you know, went before them. And then even in life reviews, they talk about self-judgment, you know, where they're made to feel the good that they cause to others, the bad that they call to others, and they wind up sort of in a level in the afterlife realm commensurate with their acts, you know. So it right. seems to jive with what you're saying. You obviously are an expert when it comes to historical mediumship, and I've quoted you often, you know, in articles that I've written. And one thing that comes to mind is, a lot of people often ask us, how come mediums can't give exact names? How come they can't communicate more specific information more often? They should be able to give a first name and a last name. And you write about the communications of Sir William Barrett to his wife, and where he explained the difficulties. He said that in the body, we have the separation of subconscious and conscious. And when we die, they join to make a complete mind. But when they try to come back to the physical realm, there's that split again. So do you think that may explain why many memories and information from people that have passed on, you know, are forgotten when they try to communicate with the physical realm?
Yeah, there are two aspects to it. Remembering the spirit himself or herself, remembering the name, but the other part, you know, the other part of his act, if he or she remembers it, then getting it through. And my understanding, and it depends upon the type of mediumship, but the clairvoyant type of mediumship is symbolic from what I understand, so that the spirit or the guide who's ever trying to get it through the medium's mind is communicating a picture of some kind. I discussed this in my blog that just went up on Monday and gave a few examples. This one author, Charles Seymour, it's an older book, 1925 or so, I think. He went to about 15 different mediums, and or no more than that, about 20, but through about 15 of them, they kept telling him that there's a Sarah here. Sarah's trying to communicate, and he didn't know who Sarah was. And, you know, how about a last name? Like, he couldn't get a surname. He finally figured out after about the 15th time with, sitting with Leslie Flint, that the person was his mother's aunt who had died at age 17 and, you know, well before he was born, well before Charles Seymour was born. So there was no family member that knew what her last name was or knew her. So, it's part of it is getting through the name through. The other part is actually remembering the name. I happened to be out for my daily walk the night before last, and there's this old friend that he used to work out at the same fitness center I did about 40 years ago. I knew his full name then. His first name is Jim. And I was, when we pass, he walks in the opposite direction. He says, "Hi, Mike." I say, "Hi, Jim." But two nights ago, I saw him coming about 100 yards away. I couldn't think of his name. And, for the next 100 yards, I kept searching my mind for it. It finally came to me about, 10 seconds before we crossed paths, and that it was Jim. So I was rescued on that one. But there's so many names I don't remember. And I think that's part of the problem. Once we, transition, the subconscious joins up with the conscious, and we remember. But then we come back to communicate, and there's a division there again between the conscious and the subconscious. And our memory is the same then as it was, as we are now in the Earth life. That's my understanding, anyway. I may be all wet on that, but. I know there's some mediums are better than others. There's one that you've certified. I read her book. I can't think of her name off the top of my head, but she seems to get names pretty easily. I've had skeptics say, "Well, how come this medium can get a name and this medium can't get a name?" And I explain that some people, the world record in the high jump is 8 feet, 1/2 inch. One person did that. If a person high jump 7 feet, that doesn't mean he's a fraud. It just means he's not as good as the person did 8 feet. And the average person can't even jump over a four foot bar. So there's as much difference between mediums as there is among athletes.
Yeah, and that's a good analogy too. I often think about that because, there have been, throughout time, both in formal research settings and just anecdotal reports of people making pacts with their loved ones, that they're going to communicate a sign, after they physically die. But who's to say that, they have recall of that sign, which may have been made up, 10 or 15 years before they passed. So, that could be a reason, because very rarely, does that happen, or a prearranged, specific sign gets communicated. But of course, signs get communicated all the time, but not necessarily, in that fashion. Well, we'll try the phone lines again. Let's go back. Do we, Don, we have a caller? Hello? Hi, Anita.
Hi, I hope you can hear me.
Yes, we can. Thanks. Welcome
excellent.
To Signs of Life.
Okay, well, I appreciate this conversation. Interestingly, when you talked about doubt, I have to say I'm on the other side. I'm 100% sure in a everlasting, eternal life of love. But I was the premise that if we had certainty that we would not aspire. But for me, I do come from a Christian background where I do believe, where in scripture it says there's many rooms in my Father's house, whether we want to take it as realms or dimensions, I think we can aspire and continue to grow in different levels, perhaps, in the afterlife. Would appreciate your thoughts on that.
Oh, I agree completely with that as far as many mansions in my Father's house. I mean, the primary message that came through the early mediumship is that, the other side is much more than the humdrum heaven and horrific hell, that religion teaches. Throw in purgatory there if you're a Catholic. Purgatory, in effect, is really, many dimensions between the ultimate Godhead, which you might call heaven, and and hell. It's, you know, a number of communicators have said there's seven realms, but, you know, it's not entirely clear that, you know, that they're just, whether they're just giving a number there to make things clearer, or whether there are in fact seven realms, that most souls seem to gravitate to the third realm, begin in the third realm, but more and more are beginning in the first and second realms, which the first realm being sort of an earthbound realm where many of the souls don't even know they're dead. So
oh,
I definitely believe in, you know, that there are many realms or dimensions or planes or whatever you want to call them.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you similarly, when you mention about being Catholic and going to Protestant, I've done, although I'm still Christian, I'm not an exclusive club where I think Protestants, their practice is good, but their belief system a little bit different, where I think in the Catholic realm, they're not going to negate whether you're Buddhist or Muslim, you know, pretty much ecumenical. And then I think, too, interesting on your perspective, I don't think Christianity negates reincarnation, although religious teachings may say that, but isn't it true that the early Jewish people at the time even questioned, I think Jesus isn't, or what the crowd, isn't John the Baptist Elijah come back from the dead? And to me, that's the reference within Christianity that they were definitely familiar with the concept of reincarnation. I'd appreciate your opinion. And then that was my last question. Thank you.
Yeah. As I mentioned, I started out on this whole subject with books on reincarnation, but I came to realize there are different schools of reincarnation, and I prefer not to subscribe to the Orthodox school, which says, you know, we're leading many lives, one after another, with maybe a 30 or 40 year gap between, or whatever. I prefer the group soul school of reincarnation, which says only a small part of the personality reincarnates, that the higher self, the greater part of the higher self, remains in the afterlife. I don't pretend to understand exactly how that works, but I don't want to come back into the world of the future, so I'm a little bit biased in that regard, and, you know, of course, by preference. But there's also the school that says that we're living all three, you know, past lives, present lives, and future lives all at the same time.
I
don't know how to comprehend that either, but I like the group soul theory, and I rarely write about reincarnation because of that, because it becomes so complex and abstract that, you know, I get lost in it.
Yeah, I think the, you know, the split soul concept is interesting because, you know, a lot of people, we get asked questions all the time when we discuss reincarnation, is people are fearful that if their loved one in spirit decides to reincarnate, that means that they'll no longer be able to communicate with them either through a medium or through personal communication. But yet it seems to happen because, you know, your consciousness can be everywhere at the same time, you know. So a piece of you may be reincarnated, but that, as Mike alluded to, the group soul or an oversoul, whatever you care to term it, you know, goes on as well. So, you know, that it's a it's certainly open to debate, but I kind of I'm leaning towards that. Anita, thank you so much for your call.
Thank you for taking it. Have a good night.
Thank you.
Thanks. Mike, you know, in writing about some of the superstars in mediumship, many of them appeared to have, you know, what they called controls, you know, essentially people assisting, you know, from the other side. Do you think it's possible that, you know, we all, when we transition and we want to get messages back to our loved ones and communicate, that we have helpers in the afterlife realm, sort of like mediums in the afterlife, that aid the process?
I think the distinction needs to be made between transmediumship and the clairvoyant type that you see mostly, or that most of us see these days. I mean, I think there's a big difference in that, and the controls come in mostly with the old transmediums. I don't know that clairvoyants really have controls. They might have guides. You probably know more about that than I do. I just, you know, it's been a few years since I really delved into, you know, modern-day clairvoyance, but the old mediums like Leonora Piper, Gladys Osborne, Leonard, the more famous mediums of that era, all had controls that supposedly, you know, were mediums on that side, that most spirits, most people who are in the spirit world cannot directly communicate through a medium, so they need a medium on that side to do the work for them, interpret what they're saying, and then pass it on through the medium on this side. But there were some that could do it directly. They didn't need the help of a control. I think it's sort of like meditation. And, you know, there are people here in the earth life who are very good at meditating, and some, like myself, who can't meditate at all. We're just, our minds are racing around too much that we're not able to meditate. And I think it's the same way on the other side, that that the ability to communicate with us comes in various degrees. There are only a very few who can do it directly and without the help of a control.
Yeah. And you mentioned, you know, some of the names of the physical, you know, mediums in the Victorian era. They were plentiful, you know, 100 years ago. And today, you know, there's, you know, only a handful, as far as I can see, of physical mediums out there, you know, around the world. And I mean, what do you attribute that to? I mean, why was physical mediumship so abundant 100 years ago when we rarely see it today?
Well, if we can believe the mediumship coming through William Stinkton Moses and a few others at that time, the spirit world started coming through, you know, during the mid 1800s. They saw at that time science had impeached religion. There were a lot of people in great despair with the nihilistic attitude of science, and they were grieving and mourning the loss of loved ones and so forth. And so the spirit world saw a need to help out, and the way they attracted attention was with the physical mediumship. But at some point, they realized that there were a lot of true physical mediums that were being called fakes, charlatans, or whatever, and because people didn't on this side didn't really understand what was going on. And so they started pulling back. Somewhere around the 1890s or early 1900s, they began pulling back. Then during World War One, there was a little resurgence there. They felt the need to come back with some physical mediumship. And then after the war was over, during the so-called Roaring Twenties, it began fading out again. We have so many escapes. Back in the 1800s, or the early 1900s, people didn't have the escape methods they have now. They didn't have radio, TV, telephone, you know, smartphones, computers, whatever. Today we have a lot more escape methods than they had back in the 1800s. So I think the spirit world saw that, you know, the lack of escape methods back then prompted the need for them to do something, whereas today there's just too much, quote, noise going on with all the electronic gadgets we have, that they either see no need for it, or they can't get through because of the noise.
So, actually, you believe it's possible that our environment could affect the process of mediumship, even in mental mediumship, right?
I've heard that, yeah. I don't know to what extent, but even the weather, they say that, you know, the weather in the United States is more conducive to mediumship than that in England, because it's drier in some places. Weather, you know, I've heard that from in four or five places, but I don't know.
You know, I just realized, you know, we're talking about physical mediumship, sort of taking for granted that everybody knows what physical mediums are. Can you just take a minute to explain to the audience what physical mediumship is?
Well, there are different types of physical mediumship, but primarily the medium generally, not always, goes into a trance and exudes a substance called ectoplasm. It's also been called teleplasm, odic force, ode, and so forth. But out of this teleplasm, manifestations are, you know, come about. Many of them were complete materializations of a deceased person. Most of them were just partial materializations, a hand. A lot of them were just a hand or a head and so forth that look somewhat fake. Or you look at the pictures of them, you say, you know, the average person can look at it and say, oh, that's not real. But some of the researchers, like Gustave Gilly of France and Charles Richer of France and so forth, they figured out that, you know, these partial materializations were just the lack of, one, the ability of the medium to produce enough ectoplasm, or two, the lack of the spirit on the other side to actually produce an image of himself. There were cases where, a few cases I'm aware of, that the medium said, the communicating spirit said he couldn't show himself because he couldn't remember what he looked like. He had to picture himself and send a projective thought form through the, you know, to the ectoplasm to get his image through, and he couldn't remember what he looked like. This is primarily before, you know, photography. A lot of people really didn't know what they looked like. You know, I think I probably discussed this with you before in a prior interview, but if we didn't have photography today, would we remember what we look like at age 7 or age 5 or, you know, even at age 12? I don't think I would. And if I were to try and project an image of myself now over the telephone wires to you, I'd probably project an image of a picture of myself at age 35 or age 30, not a picture of myself at 84. You know, when I look in the mirror and shave this morning, I, you know, wonder who that guy in the, you know, looking at me was. It wasn't the same person I visualized myself as. And
yeah.
So there's a lot to it, but that's the whole subject in itself.
Yeah. I know you write about a lot of these cases, you know, in the 25 Reasons to Believe in an Afterlife, you know, in the book, No One Really Dies. One case you wrote about was an extraordinary case where spirit materialized and dipped his hands in paraffin wax, and a physical mold of the spirit hands was made. So assuming that there was no fraud involved, and investigators really couldn't find any. It's quite extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. And the two researchers that I wrote about were the two I just mentioned, Charles Richer, who happened to be a Nobel Prize winner, and Gustave Gilly. Richer was a professor of physiology at the University of Paris, and Richer was a well-known physician in that area that they did quite a bit of research with various mediums, and they did this under very controlled conditions. I mean, they had the medium come in, they strip searched him, you know, locked the doors behind him, and then carried out the experiment. I don't recall the exact details, but anyway, they asked the spirit to dip his hand into a bucket of paraffin and produce his own hand, which they did. These paraffin gloves, so-called, are still on available someplace in Paris. I forget the name of the institute, but there are pictures of them all over the internet. And they definitely didn't come from anybody in the room. So the question is, where, you know, who produced them? If Richer and Gilly didn't produce them, or I think they had a few assistants there, but you know, there was nobody allowed into the room. And in one case, they put some coloring into the paraffin to make sure that the or to rule out the possibility that the medium didn't somehow smuggle, you know, his own paraffin into the room, and you know the paraffin glove came out with the coloring. So it was pretty foolproof, and I don't know of any other way to explain it. The skeptic will say, well, you know, somehow it was smuggled in, and or Geely was lying, or Roche was lying, or made it all up for some reason. But I think that's, as far as physical evidence, that's one of the best cases.
Yeah, I mean, there aren't many cases in the research where you have, you know, physical, tangible evidence, and that's certainly one of them. I know Leslie Kane writes about her experience with a physical medium in England, who also has spirit come through to make, you know, those paraffin hands. So evidently, you know, more than 100 years later, spirit is still looking to make that happen for whatever reason,
right.
You know.
Right.
But isn't it interesting? It was done over 100 years ago, and as incredible as that is, it still didn't flip the worldview, you know, as astounding as that may be, you know. So I think it's more of an accumulation, you know, of the evidence, and that's certainly something to consider. Also, in mediumship, unlike mental mediums today, there were cases where spirit used the vocal cords of the medium to communicate. But even more extraordinary, sometimes the voices appeared to come from somewhere else in the room, you know, not emanating through the medium or the medium's body or vocal cords. You know, could be through a floating trumpet or just out of thin air.
Right.
I mean, the only prerequisite was that the medium had to be present. So, I mean, do you have any thoughts as how the spirit voices can be produced when it's not being channeled through the medium's body itself?
Yeah, one of the mediums I talked about in the book, and I think, you know, the most evidential medium that I know of was Henrietta Wright, Wriedt, who lived, during the early 20th century, during the late 1890s, 1900s, and so forth. And she didn't even have to go into trance. She just achieved somewhat of a passive state, and she could be talking to others in the room as three or four different spirits were talking to their, you know, relatives on this side or friends on this side, whatever. And supposedly the spirits form an ectoplasmic voice box, so to speak. And there are pictures of such a voice box in the Marjorie mediumship and with a few other mediumships that, you know, this ectoplasm just forms a voice box, and that's what the spirits use. But as far as the details of that, I can't explain it.
No, but it was, you know, in reading about, you know, her, it's quite extraordinary because, you know, it's not only voices, but there was, you know, specifics, and people in the room had no doubt that they were communicating with their deceased loved ones, you know, evidence and so forth. And as you mentioned, sometimes multiple conversations taking on at once. I mean, it surpasses the Bogle theory, you know, but yet it happened. So,
right.
And then, you know, people like you are writing about it, but, you know, other than that, you don't hear much about it. What do you think, Mike, about the theory that assuming that there are spirit levels or spheres or dimensions or whatever we want to term it, that the more elevated people are in the spirit world, the harder time they have communicating back to the physical world. So in other words, somebody that's, as you mentioned, you know, earthbound or closer to the earth plane would be able to communicate easier than somebody that was more enlightened, so to speak.
Yeah, that's my understanding, that the closer in vibration the spirit is to the earth vibration, the easier it is for them to communicate with us. But some people make the mistake of thinking, a low-level spirit is necessarily an evil spirit, which is not the case. It might be that a low-level spirit is a good person or was a good person, but is still in the early stages of advancement. And there are indications that spirits on the other side have this adjustment period or adaptation period, whatever you want to call it, that, you know, takes time, however time plays out on that side, and they're still at a vibration that they can communicate directly with us. But once they advance to higher levels, it becomes more difficult, and they have to use spirits at lower levels to get their messages through. And in doing so, they, you know, the messages are often distorted. I think the best example of this was with William Satan Moses, who, you know, was an Anglican priest, and he was supposedly receiving messages from a group called the Imperator Group. Imperator was the head of the group, and at such a high level that he couldn't communicate directly, so he had to pass messages down through spirits at lower levels, the main one being called Rector, and another one Prudence, and they relayed his messages down through Moses and also later through Leonora Piper. So there was sort of a relay system involved there, but it was frequently pointed out that the messages got distorted as they came down from higher to lower levels.
Yeah, and that seems to make sense to me, because it explains why many people receive plentiful communications from their loved ones soon after their loved one passes, you know, maybe in the first couple of months or the first year, and they seem to slow down or in some cases stop as the years go by. And that could be explained because, you know, their loved one in spirit is, you know, just elevated to a higher level where it's more difficult to communicate.
Right. Yeah. There's just so much of this that's beyond human comprehension that we can only go so far in trying to understand it.
That's true. Not everybody's familiar, you've written about it, but with the process of automatic writing. Can you tell our listeners what automatic writing is?
Well, the medium, the automatic writer, lets a spirit take control of her or his arm and send their own messages through. Here again, there are various degrees of ability in that regard. Some automatic writers are able to go into a trance, and there's no question that, you know, the handwriting is even different. I mean, trying to think of his name, that the doctor that worked with Judge Edmonds, he produced all many different handwritings, and Judge Edmonds said that, you know, it came through much faster than this particular doctor could, George Dexter was his name, you know, that he could write, that he would just go into a trance state and the spirit would use his arm to write various messages.
Yeah, it's and a lot of people have reported, you know, not non-mediums, that they've been able to do this as well, you know, so it's it can, you don't necessarily have to be a writing for a medium for spirit to be able to communicate in that process.
You got to define what a medium. I mean, here again, the person probably is a medium if he's getting messages from, you know, spirit. Then what else do you call him?
Right. By definition, it's a medium. They're a medium. You're right. let's take another call before we run out of time. Hello, Nielsen.
Hi.
Well, welcome to Signs of Life. You're on with Michael Tim. Did you have a question?
I have a question. And the strange thing is, let me preface this. In the few weeks ago, my dog, Charlie, passed away on Mother's Day. And I left his urn in my room. Usually I put it in another room where someone will be near it during that evening. but for some reason I forgot. My surveillance camera captured several orbs flying around on that night. And then several days later, I woke up, and in the middle of the night, like 2 o'clock, and I asked Charlie, "Are you there? If you are, please beep the Bluetooth phone." In 1 or 2 minutes, it beeped 2 times. I was still skeptical. So 2 days later, I woke up again, this time around 4 in the morning, and asked the same question. In 1 to 2 minutes, it beeped again, but this time it was nonstop. So I relodged the phone onto the charger and went to the restroom. I came back, he did it again while I was in the bathroom. So I rushed to do it because people are sleeping. Okay, fast forward to last night. I asked the same question, but not during any kind of particular thing. It was during the whole day I was asking, could you give me another sign by beeping the phone? And I didn't get that response. But then last night I dreamed that he beeped the phone, and it seemed so real. So it in relation to what you just said, that over time that they start to have a hard time facilitating communications during the later days or as they go through this process, it may be that they can't manipulate objects like they used to. But then my question to Mr. Tim is, in relation to animals, I've read so many opinions on animals. Dr. Michael Newton says that dogs, for example, go to a separate heaven or sphere. But some mediums say that when loved ones encounter their pets, they are with their other loved ones who have since passed over. So it's kind of contradictory in some sense, but in some sense, maybe Dr. Michael Newton's explanation that they can be called upon from the sphere and brought over to the human's heaven for not permanent, but temporary, you know, reunions. Yeah. What is your opinion on animals and their reincarnations and all those aspects that apply to humans? Do they have the same or similar experience, or do they have a separate experience?
Yeah,
that's a tough one, and animal survival is something that I haven't written much about because I don't have a good grasp on it myself, and I haven't seen anything that really explains it other than that animals who are in close affinity with humans on this side do survive, mm-hmm. and those who are not in close affinity with someone on this side, maybe wild animals or whatever, survive mm-hmm. in a group soul, but of some mm-hmm. kind. But you know, trying to comprehend or visualize that group soul is beyond me. I mean, I do believe yeah. that you know, animals that you know that are pets and in our lives do survive to some extent, but it's really beyond my domain.
Yeah, I would add. You know, Nielsen, that having, you know, witnessed, you know, hundreds upon hundreds of medium readings, there's a very large percentage of times when mediums do bring through deceased animals, you know, so the evidence uh-huh. seems to show that, yes, indeed, you know, animal consciousness, you know, survives their physical death. And you're correct. I mean, they, you know, when somebody's loved one, a physical loved one, you know, passes on and they're trying to communicate with them from the spirit realm and giving evidence uh-huh. so that their loved one knows that they still survive, very often part of that evidence is, you know, that so-and-so, you know, that their family dog or, you know, cat is there with them, you know, so there's, uh-huh. you know, raising the possibility that, that just the way near-death experiences talk about traveling to the other side and seeing their mm-hmm. deceased loved ones waiting for them, the same mm-hmm. thing may be true when it comes to animal consciousness.
Mm-hmm. In fact, Dr. Weiss, Brian Weiss, who does past life regression, has yeah. said in terms that animals, there's no impossibility that they can be reincarnated as humans. And there was a case study in Thailand where there was evidential physical proof where a snake was reincarnated as a human, and they had proof, evidence of it, in the fact that the snake had reincarnated into a boy's body, and the killer of that snake had a snake bite exactly where that child said he bit him.
But then Dr. Casey has said, it's certainly within the realm of possibility. You don't see very much in forms of evidence of that in the formal reincarnation research like by Ian Stevenson and Jim Tucker, and others. So that really hasn't come up. But as Michael had said, these are things that we can't truly know, at least not while we're in the physical world, which you can only conjecture. Mm-hmm. But Nielsen, thanks. We're almost running out of time, but thanks so much for calling.
Thank you so much.
All right. Take care. Mike, before we go, considering all of the disciplines of survival research, you have your personal opinion about what offers the most compelling evidence of an afterlife? I assume that your answer is going to be physical mediumship, but I don't want to put...
No, not necessarily physical, trans-mediumship. Leonora Piper wasn't a physical medium. She didn't really produce anything physical. It was all mental, but she was a trans-medium. Same with Gladys Osborne Leonard. I think the story of Leonora Piper, I wrote a book about her, Resurrecting Leonora Piper. I think, that case alone, if you look at all the research that was done with her, offers evidence, overwhelming evidence or compelling evidence, however you want to, categorize it, that consciousness survives death. There are a lot of mediums today and a lot of other phenomena, as I'd mentioned, that are icing on the cake, but I think the story of Leonora Piper in itself offers the best evidence.
Yeah, all right. Well, appreciate that. And Mike was alluding to some of his books, by the way, The Articulate Dead, Running on Third Wind, The Afterlife Revealed, Transcending the Titanic. That's a really interesting book. The Afterlife Explorers, Resurrecting Leonora Piper, and Dead Men Talking, and the book that we were referencing tonight, No One Really Dies, 25 Reasons to Believe in an Afterlife. And, we just touched upon some of these cases, but you might want to pick that up. You can find that book in all sources, Amazon and so forth. You can learn more about Michael's work. He's a true authority on the subject. The publishing house that publishes his books is White Crow Books, and he maintains a blog. It's whitecrowbooks.com/MichaelTim, and Tim is TYMN. Or if you forget that, go to foreverfamilyfoundation.org. Under Afterlife Science, there's a section on consciousness blogs, and there's a link to take you right into that blog article. You working on any new books, Michael?
Not really. I have one in mind that goes more into the nature of the afterlife rather than the evidence for it, but that may take a couple of years, assuming I live that long, but not immediate.
We'll look for that, and you'll have to come back if and when that materializes. Thank you for being with us. I appreciate it, and I hope to be with you again soon.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it, Bob.
You're welcome. And now it's time to say, as we do when we end the show, that our loved ones are only a heartbeat away, and science is going to prove it. Good night, everyone.